It's time for Rockin' the Boat. My name is the V-Man, and this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 on your FM dial. Today, we're going to be joined by Anas Shalal. He's the founder of Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives, a nonpartisan ad hoc organization created in the lead-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. We're going to be discussing post-war Iraq in just a moment. Please stand by. Rockin' the Boat, coming your way, 5:30 to 6 each weekday here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. April 9th, 2003. An American tank topples a larger-than-life statue of Saddam Hussein in central Baghdad. A seemingly large crowd has gathered and is celebrating. We all saw the images beamed across the major U.S. media. Now, it's been 6 weeks since the fall of the statue in Baghdad and the ousting of the regime of Saddam Hussein. Iraq's infrastructure has been left in shambles as chaos reigns the country now. The U.S. forces who trumpet themselves as liberators on the nightly news, though able-bodied and equipped, have stood by and watched as Iraqi civilians have looted government ministries, museums, and warehouses. After securing Iraq's oil ministry, the United States government seemed interested in little else. No weapons of mass destruction, no Saddam Hussein, Iraq's people free to destroy their own country. Now the U.S. is pushing to lift the economic sanctions on Iraq, which for nearly 13 years have crippled the population and contributed to widespread disease and malnourishment. Some estimates say over 1 million people have died due to the effects of sanctions. Lifting the sanctions is great, but the question is, who will control the flow of resources, Iraqis or Americans? Well, today on Rockin' the Boat, we'll pose that and other questions to Anas Shalal. He is a Sunni Muslim and a founder of Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives, a nonpartisan ad hoc organization created in the lead-up to the United States invasion of Iraq. Anas, I want to thank you for being with me today here on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us first, how long have you been in the United States and why did you leave Iraq?
I've been here since 1966. I would not feel very comfortable being identified as a Sunni Muslim because it automatically assumes that Iraqis like to identify themselves by their sectors and their ethnicity and their religion, and that's not necessarily how Iraqis perceive themselves. I think this division between Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds and Christians and all that has been way overblown out of proportion. So
fair
I just
enough.
Wanted. So to be clear with that.
Okay, I just want to point out I did read that in a Washington Post article
that
described you.
My family came here in 1966. We moved to the United States. My father was a diplomat with the Egyptian government, actually. He was an Iraqi, but he was representing the Arab League, which at that time was and still is under the auspices of Egypt. And he was sent here as a representative for the Arab League. And shortly thereafter, the 1967 Arab-Israeli War broke out, and relations with the United States were severed, and we stayed in this country rather than returning back after his post was canceled.
I see. Well, let's talk a little bit about the group you founded then, Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives. I mentioned you were founded in the lead-up to the U.S. invasion. Tell us a little bit about how this all came together, who it consists of, that kind of stuff.
The whole lead-up to the war, there was a lot of Iraqis that were being interviewed on television, and most of them were very much in favor of the war. And they had their various reasons for why they were in favor of the war. We, as Iraqi Americans living here in the Washington metropolitan area, were kind of surprised, actually, by how many Iraqis were for this war. So we did sort of a straw survey of to see what kind of response do Iraqis here in this area feel about this war, and do they think that this war is justified or appropriate, or whatever. And we talked to many, many people around here in this area, as well as calling people from that we have contacts with in different cities all over the country here in the United States. And almost without exception, everyone was against this war. Now, even the ones that were for the war had a lot of hesitation. But that's not what we were hearing on television. The Iraqi National Congress, led by Ahmed Chalabi and others, were espousing this sort of idea that Iraqis cannot wait for the U.S. troops to come in. They'll have, you know, candy and flowers thrown in front of them, and things will be just wonderful, and the birds will be singing, and the bees will be buzzing, and everything will be wonderful the day after the invasion stops. And as we see, this did not really play out in the way they had led the United States to believe.
Mm-hmm. Again, we're speaking with Anas Shalal of Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives. Let's give a little precursor too, because I mean, I think it's important to address issues of how this whole war started. I mean, what are your thoughts about the U.S.? Some of the reasons they made. I mean, now we're not seeing any weapons of mass destruction, as I pointed out in the intro, and that was a huge, huge reason that they tried to push forth in the mainstream press to justify it, and that sort of just disappeared. I mean, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, we were speaking about the whole idea of the weapons of mass destruction. We were looking at the U.S. and its role as a world leader, having, you know, garnered so much goodwill after 9/11. The world was behind us. They were standing behind us, helping us out in our war on terrorism and so on. And we thought at least, as Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives, we thought we were just squandering all this goodwill by sort of acting like bullies going through with this plan of preemptive strike and so on. So we were looking at it in terms of, as Americans, we felt that this wasn't the right thing to do. The whole idea of the weapons of mass destruction, well, that's what the United Nations was for. That's what the inspectors were for. And the inspectors were giving us some progress reports that seemed to be going in the right direction. But it seemed like we were in such a rush to move forward that, you know, this was already a done deal way before that. You know, when you start looking at, other papers that have come out since then and other exposés that have been done on several groups that have already been planning for this type of invasion, for this type of control of oil and resources and so on in that part of the world, it sort of made more sense then. This was just a pretext, and I think it's becoming very apparent that this is what's happened, that all of this sort of diplomatic footsie was really just a dance, a charade that was leading up to an imminent war that it was already planned way before that.
You mentioned you came here in 1966. Saddam Hussein rose to power shortly after that time period. Can you talk a little bit about his regime, your view of it? Should he have just been left in power? Some have said that. I mean, some have made that claim that maybe he should have just been left alone. Iraqis are saying this, that, you know, things were bad, yes, under Saddam, but now things are far worse. And I mean, could you address that?
Yeah, I would say most Iraqis would probably feel that things are far worse right now. The whole problem, I think, what happened with Saddam Hussein is during his worst excesses, during the time when he was really the butcher of Baghdad, when he killed so many people, so many innocent people, we were his best allies at
exactly.
that time. And, you know, in these past few years, he's actually been, mild as compared to the way he was. And for us to suddenly sort of get on our high horse and say, oh, my goodness, look at all this atrocities that he's done, we need to get rid of him at this point, seems really kind of, you know, it just didn't make sense. I think it didn't make sense to the Iraqi people, because the Iraqi people knew that at the time when he was at his worst, the United States was his ally. Rumsfeld was in Iraq in 1983 and 1984, gave Iraq a clean bill of health and said that these are the type of people we need in the Middle East. They like the idea of a strong man they can talk to, and would adhere to push their policies forward. The fact that Iran was a troublesome spot for us at that time made it even more palatable for us to have someone like Saddam Hussein next door, keeping check on them. And that war, of course, that lasted for 8 years, that most of the people in the world, and especially the Iraqi people, know that was a war that was really not just Saddam Hussein's, but it was America's war. And America had supported Saddam Hussein, using him as a tool to fend off the Iranian fundamentalists that were rising at that time.
And then, of course, a few years later, we had the Gulf War, and the U.S. military there targeted again civilian infrastructure such as bridges and electricity plants,
right,
and
I mean,
water treatments and schools.
It's interesting now they're talking about lifting the sanctions because they're saying the sanctions have been so awful for the Iraqi people. Well, we've been saying that for 12 years, that the sanctions have been horrible for the Iraqi people. And, you know, it's interesting how we're finally beginning to admit that the fact the sanctions were so brutal and they were really genocidal. They killed almost 1 million people, as you mentioned in your earlier report.
Right. And even if, right now the U.S. is pushing this thing in front of the United Nations, not only to lift the sanctions, but to grant them and Britain sole power in Iraq.
Sole power, yeah.
And
yeah.
I guess, I mean, aside from lifting the sanctions, do you think that even goes far enough? I mean, does that adequately address all the medical and humanitarian needs that are?
Well, yeah. I mean, now that the United States and Britain have declared themselves the occupying power, it's their responsibility to make sure that all these needs are met. So, I don't think it will address just lifting the sanctions by themselves will obviously open up doors of having, many products that were banned before to be brought into Iraq and hopefully try to bring Iraq back to where it was years ago. Iraq at one point was a very progressive country with lots of significant infrastructure, a very important medical sort of center for the Middle East that many people came from other areas in the Middle East to have surgery and special operations done there because the medical system was so far more advanced than other countries in the region. Women were being allowed to be a very important part of civil society. Education was high in the ranks. There was a lot of things that were happening in Iraq that were very, very good. Unfortunately, the brutality and the horrors that Saddam Hussein brought and the fear sort of paralyzed the country and made it into the pariah that it became.
And that, what you just mentioned, coupled with, the 12 years of sanctions by the U.S. and now this current bombing that began March 20th in the war there, which obviously left thousands of civilians dead, estimates up to 5,000 on IraqBodyCount.net.
Yes.
And not to mention that, tens of thousands of conscripts in the Saddam Hussein's army.
Absolutely.
And now we're left in Iraq with long lines at gas stations, almost no telephone service, power blackouts, mass looting, no clean water. Anas Shalal, how is it that the U.S. could plan every single step of the war where, the military aspects, but then be so ignorant about these after effects?
Well, we were saying right from the beginning, Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives, we were all saying how this is not really a war to liberate the Iraqi people. This is just a charade to try to win over the resources of Iraq and have control over Iraqi oil and the region. And, of course, that became even that much more clear when we saw, right, as soon as the collapse of the government on April 9th, the only ministry that was protected was the Ministry of Oil, while all other ministries and other places were left to be looted by the people there, including the Museum of Baghdad, the Museum of Antiquities, which housed some of the rarest and oldest pieces of art in the world, were left open for looters to come in. And there's reports, and we hear from relatives back there where they saw with their own eyes, American military officials telling people to just go right ahead and help themselves.
Yeah.
So so all of these things, I think, added together show a lack of respect, first of all, for the people of Iraq, for their identity, and shows that this is really all about oil and natural resources of Iraq and nothing to do with the people of Iraq.
You mentioned earlier Iraqi National Congress leader Ahmed Chalabi.
And yes.
He was brought into Iraq under tight military security. In fact, I think even some of his henchmen were assassinated bringing him in. But can you tell us a little bit about who this man is and what part did he play first in toppling that statue, and what part do you think he'll play in any kind of U.S. client state that's emerging?
Let's be clear. I think the toppling of the statue, although it's been played up an awful lot, there's been many special websites that have shown this, and we've heard reports also from the ground, where the day of the toppling of the statue, there was only about, at the most, 200 people that were doing this with the help of the military and tanks to be able to pull it down. Most of the other people were just standing with their mouths open watching this happen. It wasn't this sort of jubilant excitement that was sort of portrayed by the U.S. media of what was happening that day. It was more a really sense of shock and surprise and sort of fear as well, see where is this leading to. We know that Saddam Hussein is gone. We don't like him. That's great. But what's next? And so it was a, sort of a, the Iraqi people were sort of taking a wait-and-see attitude, I think, to see what happens. But as far as Ahmed Chalabi is concerned and his history, he, as maybe many of your listeners have heard or know, was convicted of embezzlement and 32 counts of felonies in Jordan after starting a bank called the Petra Bank with his family's money. He started this bank, and the bank went belly up, and lots of people lost their. It was a lot like the SNL crisis that we had here in this country, in a sense. He was then asked to testify and was convicted in absentia because he ran away and did not show up to court. He was whisked away in the trunk of a car and taken out and ended up residing in London for some time. And then, you know, only to sort of reconstitute himself and come back here as the new would-be de facto leader of Iraq. Of course, the Iraqi people did not forget about this guy. Not many people really know him, and the ones that do know him as a thief, the thief of Baghdad. Mm-hmm. That's his nickname. And he was brought in, like you said, with about 700 fighters that were trained under U.S. military supervision and brought back, and he's set up shop in a very posh club in Iraq right now in Baghdad. He's used to the posh life. He likes Rolex and Gucci, and he does quite well in limousines, and people are just, the Iraqi people are really not too open to that type of leader coming in, sort of parachuting himself into Baghdad and making himself the new savior of Iraq.
We're speaking with Anas Shalal. He's an Iraqi-American. He's with Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives, and he's joining me here on Rockin' the Boat. My name is The V-Man. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'll be with you till 6 o'clock. Anas, I'm looking at Wednesday, May 21st edition of the San Jose Mercury News. There's an article called Iraqis' Patience Runs Thin. Mm-hmm. Skipping about halfway through the article, I want to briefly read you a quote and then the comment by the U.S. officials. Mm-hmm. Quote, Iraqi people believe that America is like a god, that it can do anything with the snap of its fingers like in Hollywood movies, said Murad Diramarian, a 22-year-old goldsmith. But America has proven that it is a failure, end quote. U.S. officials say that's the problem. It's not that the reconstruction effort has failed. It's that Iraqis have exceptionally high, if not unreasonable, expectations. And that's from the May 21st edition of the San Jose Mercury News, and the title of the article is Iraqis' Patience Runs Thin. What do you make of that, Anas?
Well, I agree. I think the expectations have been raised to such an impossible level that it's going to be very hard to please the Iraqi people at this point. You know, I think for the Iraqis that are living in Iraq or at the time that Saddam Hussein was there during the last year or so, they've weathered all kinds of storms. They've weathered, you know, Saddam Hussein brutality. They've weathered the sanctions, and they've just started to sort of like evening out their lives at that point. Iraqis are survivors, and the ones that stayed obviously are apolitical in most sense of the word, and they've learned to sort of just live and let live. And so when this invasion came in, it was an intrusion on a life that they've been able to piece together little by little to get to where they are. So unless this is going to make their life better, and not just politically, because they've learned to live without the political aspect of their life, but better in many other ways, for example, in the infrastructure they have to deal with, in their ability to obtain food and shelter and safety and so on and so forth, all of those things, if this is going to make their life better in those aspects, then they're willing to give this a chance. So far, it's made their life very miserable. We speak to relatives there who are afraid to walk out of their homes. They're afraid to go shopping. They're afraid to buy food. They're afraid to send their kids to schools. They're afraid to drive their cars. All of these things are creating a sense that this is not good, that what's happened to Iraq is not for the better, but for the worse. So unless we come up with something, and quickly, because already they've had almost 2 months of no electricity, there's dirty water all over the place. People are dying from all kinds of waterborne diseases and other diseases. Iraq gets extremely hot, excruciatingly hot this time of year, and it's only going to get worse.
And
unless they start having some sort of infrastructure there that they can depend on, it's going to be very frustrating for the Iraqi people, and they're going to want to see America get the hell out of there.
Another problem of this whole dynamic is that the United States military that are in Iraq, occupying Iraq, are inexperienced in terms of occupying, and they have orders to shoot looters, and they have committed massacres at nonviolent peaceful demonstrations. I mean, so this is really bad. What do you think should be done about the situation right now, and what international body could step in and sort of try to make a
That's the thing. I think
workable situation.
We have to start including the international community. We have to start being less selfish about this and holding it. It's, you know, they've caught this prize and they don't want to give it up to anybody. You know, so it's becoming clearer and clearer to the Iraqi people that this is a prize that they have caught, and they're not willing to allow Arab countries. They're not willing to allow the United Nations or any other countries to come in, Muslim countries to come in and help in creating the peace and be able to move forward with trying to create some infrastructure and civil society in Iraq. So if this is only going to be America's thing, it's not going to work. You're right. They're not experienced with the culture. They're not experienced with the area. They're not experienced with the weather. There's many issues that happen in Iraq that the American military is not really experienced in handling at this point. And it's the frustration on both sides is going to escalate, and you're going to have people getting shot because, you know, they look funny or they act funny or they do something, and, you know, people are going to get hurt. Innocent people are going to get hurt, as we've seen, like you mentioned, in some of the peaceful demonstrations that have happened where, a soldier hears a shot coming from somewhere, opens fire on a crowd. I mean, that's something that the Iraqi people would expect from Saddam Hussein. They certainly don't expect it from their liberator, America.
We're speaking with Anas Shalal of Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives. And we got about 6 minutes left here, Anas. So I guess I just would like to maybe throw it to you again and see if there's any more that can be done here from the United States. What can we do to put pressure on our government to allow for an international body to come in? What avenues of action can you suggest, or maybe even sources of information?
Yeah, we keep sort of shifting the goalpost. You know, already today, Bremer came out and said, "Oh, we have to wait at least 7 or 8 weeks before we even begin considering a new possibility of a government in Iraq." So already, it's already been about 6 or 7 weeks, and now we're going to add another 8 weeks, and who knows what's going to happen when we get to that point, maybe another moving of the goalposts. So we keep sort of shifting things. Like you said earlier, we came in for weapons of mass destruction. Now who knows what we're there for? Liberate the Iraqi people, where we've liberated them, but they're miserable, so what do we do, and so on. So, all of these things get redefined and changed as we move forward. Iraqis here in America feel helpless because they have family that they talk to on a regular basis, and they see the frustration that their families are facing every single day just to obtain the basics human needs like water, like electricity, and so on. So groups are forming here. There's a group, Iraqi American Council, that's beginning to form here, which is a group that's trying to get all the different factions of Iraqis, Kurds, Muslims, Shiites, Christians, everybody here, to try to create a an umbrella group or a foundation for different groups to come together so that we can start putting more pressure on our government here in America. As Americans and as Iraqis, we are unique in that sense in being able to address issues on both sides of the ocean. And so that's the kind of work that we're doing right now, is trying to create structures here that can, you know, begin to lobby on behalf of the Iraqi people there, because they are voiceless at this point.
Do you think you'd ever live in a free Iraq if you had the opportunity? Would you go back?
No, I wouldn't go back. No. I think most Iraqi Americans probably would not go back. You know, they're happy here in their new home here in America, and we're all proud Americans. And I think, but we do want the best for Iraq. We do want to be able to go back and visit. We do want to have our families be happy and comfortable there. I'd like to think that we will be able to see a free Iraq that we can all be proud of and be able to go back to and visit. I just don't think it's very close at hand. I think it's many, many years away, and unfortunately, many more lives are going to be shed before before we see happier days.
Well, I hate to end on a sad note, but that seems like a good place to stop here. Any final thoughts on us, Shalal?
Well, I think, you know, we tend to be very myopic in the way we see things, and we tend to move from one problem to another. Iraq is going to be forgotten like Afghanistan was forgotten. Mm-hmm. Today. Four people were killed in Afghanistan, again by accident, by U.S. troops because of whatever they thought it was something, and end up to be just a family. But anyway, these things are going to continue to happen. Already we've taken our hands away from Afghanistan practically. Afghanistan is falling into all kinds of disarray. Iraq, we were not prepared to be there as peacekeepers. When we went into Bosnia, Bosnia is made up of 4 million people, and there were 60,000 troops there. In Iraq, there's only about 120,000, 130,000 troops, and that's a country of 24 million. We need about a half a million troops in order to be able to handle this peacefully and in an orderly fashion. Otherwise, mistakes are going to happen, people are going to be frustrated, and unfortunately, again, innocent lives are going to be shed, and the Americans are going to look worse and worse and worse. We don't want America to look bad in the face of the world, and particularly not in the Middle East.
Well, Anas Shalal, I really appreciate it. We are out of time here on Rocking the Boat. I want to thank you for joining us tonight, and hopefully we'll keep abreast of the situation at least and try to activate our listeners to do something.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Good Bye-bye. Night.
And that does it for tonight's edition of Rocking the Boat here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. My name is the V-Man. And I'll be back tomorrow, 5:30 to 6. I'll try to do a community calendar, and we may be hearing some other interesting updates from news happenings around the world. Friday, my guest will be Richard Falk. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at College 10 at UC Santa Cruz, 7 o'clock. Richard Falk, he is going to be discussing Palestine and Iraq, a new century of imperialism in the Middle East. And we're going to end right now with a track from the Adbusters magazine. It's the last track by King Britt, Ursula Rucker, Human Beings Want to Be Happy. Thanks for listening to Rockin' the Boat.
Human beings want to be happy. We have a need not just to live, but to thrive. At the most basic level, we need food and water for sustenance and shelter from the elements. And even though it may not seem like it when you watch television, we all really do want peace in our lives. We want a sense of purpose and belonging. To put it simply, we each want to feel satisfied with who we are and what we have. We all want good lives.